welcome back to the second half of our episode. I hope you had a restful break.
I did, and cool. I hope we can keep this down to a manageable length, but let's see. Right now, Claude's going to give us the plot description for Hannah,
this
the movie.
Goes much more quickly, thank goodness. This film opens in a snowy wilderness in northern Finland. In the woods, we see someone stalking a reindeer with a bow and arrow, and I think the reindeer is played by Blitzen, but I'm not sure. She takes aim and fires, striking the reindeer in the side. The reindeer groans and runs away, and the person takes pursuit. Finally, the reindeer falls over. The hunter catches up with the fallen animal and removes the arrow. We see that the hunter is a teenage girl, and she's a little upset, saying, "I just missed your heart." And then she finishes off the reindeer with a handgun. Smash cut to the title in white on a red background. As she's preparing the body for removal back home, a man comes up behind her and says, "You're dead. I killed you." The two fight for a minute, but before long, we realize that it's a training exercise, and that's how we meet the Heller family. That would be Eric, played by Eric Bana, and his daughter Hannah, who's played by Saoirse Ronan. The two have been living here for the better part of her life, and he's been training her, rather, in the ways of espionage, counter-espionage, spycraft. It's not 100% clear yet. But in addition to being pretty deadly with multiple weapons and speaking at least six different languages, he's also been educating her about the world and building a fake backstory with her. Of course, being in the middle of Nowheresville, Finland, also means she's not learning anything about modern conveniences, such as the internet and pop music and electricity and plumbing and stuff like that. One night, Hannah approaches Eric and tells him that she is ready, so he literally digs up a box containing an old transmitter, which he gives to her. After thinking about the situation for a little bit, Hannah flips the switch, sending a signal of her location to Marissa Wiegler, a corrupt CIA agent who is played by Cate Blanchett. Marissa sends a team to Eric's cabin, where Hannah, who had been waiting for them after Eric's departure in what must be a thermally lined three-piece suit, is captured and taken to a CIA location in Morocco. There, she discovers that Eric is a former CIA agent who betrayed the agency and knows a secret that cannot become public. Marissa has been assigned to kill him, but Eric has trained Hannah to kill Marissa. Knowing that Hannah was captured too easily, Marissa sends in a body double, that would be Michelle Dockery in her feature debut, to speak with Hannah. Hannah kills the false Marissa, breaks free, and escapes the compound. While on the run through the desert, she meets a family, and that would be Sebastian and Rachel, they're played by Jason Fleming and Olivia Williams, and befriends their daughter Sophie, who's played by Jessica Barden, and their son Miles, who is played by Allo Maland. After Hannah stows away in the back of their minivan to get to the European mainland, they decide to help her get to Berlin after she tells them her fake backstory, and they buy it. Meanwhile, Marissa hires a mercenary called Isaacs, who's played by Tom Hollander, to capture Hannah while she goes after Eric, who is known by now to be in Germany. Later, Isaacs and his men corner Hannah and her family, but she manages to escape after killing one of Isaacs' men. The boy of the captured family, who has a little bit of crush on Hannah, is tricked into telling Marissa that Hannah is heading for Berlin. Unfortunately, we have no idea what happens to the family after this. Their storyline's just over now. In Berlin, Hannah meets with one of her father's associates, Knepfler, who lives in an abandoned amusement park, to rendezvous with her father. However, Marissa and Isaacs know where she's headed, and they catch up with them. They kill Knepfler, but Hannah escapes. She eventually meets with her father at her grandmother's apartment, where she discovers that Marissa has murdered her grandmother. Hannah learns there that Eric is not actually her father, and then Eric finally confesses the truth. He was once a recruiter for a program in which pregnant women were recruited from abortion clinics so that the CIA could alter the children's DNA, enhancing their strength, their stamina, and their reflexes while suppressing emotions like fear and empathy in order to create a batch of super soldiers. The project was, however, deemed a failure by the CIA higher-ups, and all the women and their genetically modified children were eliminated. Eric, who was unwilling to allow Hannah and her mother to be killed, tried to escape with them, but Marissa murders Hannah's mother and pinned it on Eric. Meanwhile, Eric escaped with Hannah to their cabin, where in complete isolation, he was able to train her to avenge her mother while preventing the CIA from locating them. Their discussion is interrupted by Marissa and Isaacs, and Eric acts as a distraction to allow Hannah to escape. Eric kills Isaacs and his partner, but is eventually shot and killed by Marissa. Marissa then chases Hannah back to the abandoned amusement park, where the two finally have a standoff. Hannah pleads for an end to the killing, but Marissa shoots Hannah in the side, who in turn wounds Marissa with an improvised bow and arrow. As Marissa attempts to flee, Hannah hunts her to the top of a tall slide, which causes Marissa to fall down the slide, dropping her gun. Hannah walks down the slide and retrieves the gun. And in a nice echo of the opening of the film, she looks down on Marissa. She says, this time with no remorse at all, "I just missed your heart," then raises the gun and fires. Smash cut to the title again and close credits. And during the closing credits, there are two pieces of music played, and at the end of the first piece, we hear Eric's voice saying something he had said early in the film, defining music as a combination of sounds with a view to beauty of form and expression of emotion. Then at the very end of the credits, we hear more speaking, and I think it's also Eric saying "Schlaf wieder," which translates to "go back to sleep."
It is Eric.
Okay, cool.
So, when I said the term blacklist, there are a couple different meanings there. The blacklist, of course, that took place in Hollywood in the late 40s and through most of the 50s, where anyone who was a suspected communist was not able to work in Hollywood under their own name, be it actor, writer, or director. And in a future episode, we're going to talk about a movie made by one of the most controversial figures surrounding the blacklist. And then when I said blacklist, I also could mean a TV series that ran on for several years on NBC starring James Spader. But in the context of this movie, the blacklist refers to a unofficial list that's made every year of the best screenplays that have not been filmed as of the year they make the list. I remember first hearing about this back in the 80s when my dad subscribed to the magazine that the American Film Institute put out every month. And one year I remember a couple of the screenplays that were on the list that eventually got made into movies. They included The Princess Bride, which took about 15 years to make it to the screen, and another cult movie, which I have not seen, called Miracle Mile, although I've heard good things about it. And the reason why I'm bringing all this up is that the original script for Hannah, which was written by Seth Lockheed, was on the blacklist for a few years. And originally, it was a grittier version of the story. But when Joe Wright became the director on this project, and it was Saoirse Ronan who brought him on as director, since she had worked with him on Atonement and gotten along with him. Wright was the one who brought in David Farr to rewrite the movie and to push it towards a more fairy tale element. Now, a fairy tale type of story. Now, the most obvious representation, of course, is Grimm Park,
yeah,
where you've got these elements, you've got these things in the amusement park that look like giant animals and things like that. But again, like with Bride with White Hair, it's the wit, which also had, you know, fairy tale elements, like the fact that the Bridget Lynn character was called the Wolf Girl. You have the type of story the way that the story is told, you know, and the fact that, for example, Cate Blanchett is almost like a big bad wolf type character, and you know, Hannah is trying to get to grandmother's house. You know, that's borrowing from other fairy tales. Now, I don't know if the grittier story would have worked if it would have been told in a gritty manner, but I do know this. I think the way that Wright tells a story in a fairy tale manner makes it work all the better. How about you, Claude? Were you caught up in this as well? Or
I did. Now, my entry to this story was the TV series, actually, that came from it. I had seen that first before I saw this. And so I learned a little bit about that, and I was like, well, that sounds interesting. And I watched that series, and I kind of liked it. You know, the problem that that series had, as most of the series with this sort of conceit going on, is you got to come up with an ending for it, and they did manage to do that, so I was more or less satisfied with that. You know, with this it was a little bit different, because this particular story, I don't know, it was like I had a little bit of difficulty because knowing where it kind of had to go, and recognizing that David Farr, who had worked on the film, actually was the person who developed the plot for the series. So,
right.
So that it was going to be a lot of the same elements. But the thing is, I was kind of waiting for the reveals to come. So that I was a little bit spoiled on myself for this particular film. And I think actually some of the things that he handled in the series worked out a little bit better than it did in the film, believe it or not. Like, I think his encounter with Sophie and her family was a little bit of a smoother transition than it was here. And also just because we had a little bit of extra time to breathe with the story, and Hannah being exposed to the modern conveniences. And, like, you know, we see early on, she's like fascinated by the tea kettle and the fluorescent light and has no idea what's going on when she sees the TV. And so, you know, we get to see that kind of drawn out a little bit more. Also the encounter with the boys, gets to be pulled out a little bit more. So I had to really temper myself a little bit in watching this film to say, okay, when is this going to happen? How do we get from point A to point B, and what's ultimately going to happen? And is this film going to be left open-ended? And in fact, it does not, because Marissa dies at the end of here. Whereas over the course of the series, Marissa actually goes from an antagonist to somebody who ultimately winds up helping her out toward the end, but still manages to pay the price for it. It was just well done all around. So let me come back to the film. I think it was well done. I really do. Even though, like I said, I knew kind of what was coming up, just trying to anticipate it, wondering where the beats were going to go. I think they went really, really well. And I also did like that parallel construction at the beginning and the end, where you've got, it's not just a shot of Hannah, like, looking down at the deer and then Marissa, but it's specific, like, Hannah looking directly into the camera saying, I just missed your heart. And then the gun coming up to basically fill the screen and the shot going off, cutting to the title card. I like the way that ran as well. That was well done.
Okay. Well, see, I watched only the first season of the show, and I didn't like it as much, part of which had to do with the fact that I don't think the acting was as good for the three lead roles in the series as it was in the movie. You know, I do think that what's her face?
Creed Miles
was good in the title role, even though I think Ronan did a better job. But I think Eric Bana was much better as Eric than Joel Kinnaman. And similarly, I think Cate Blanchett was better as Marissa than Muriel Enos was, even if the characters were more developed in the series. I just think that Bana and Blanchett's embodied them better in the movie. And also, I kept getting the feeling that in the show, at least for the first season, Farr wasn't sure whether he wanted to make it more on the realistic side or more on the fairy tale side. Whereas Farr and Wright in the movie, you know, they keep just enough of the realistic side to make the plot work, but at the same time, they lean into the fairy tale tone, which I think is a better choice, or right. was a better choice.
Yeah, and I don't really want to like spend the whole time, you know, comparing the series to the film, but I will say this, is that Blanchett, because her character basically has a beginning and a middle and an end, so she can be a certain way and stay a certain way right up until the point where she dies. Boom, and that's over. Whereas Enos had a little bit of a, I mean, there was an arc that she had to go through. And so she starts out one way and she has to develop over the course of the series. And so there is a little bit more, just like a little bit of like more of her conscience eating at her a little bit over the course of the series, so that finally she does, you know, turn and become an ally, you know, toward the last part of the last season. You know, it's basically she, again, it's just room to do that sort of thing. You don't have that luxury with a film. And so, you know, it's just a little bit
different. I understand that. I'm just saying that I never saw her being as capable of doing that over the course of the series.
Okay. But that's fair.
That's me.
That's fair.
One thing that, you know, I think also adds to the way that the movie works is the score by the Chemical Brothers.
Yeah.
You know, when rock stars or modern music groups decide to or are called upon to write scores for movies, I would say in the last 10, 15 years that they've been doing that, we've seen some really interesting results. We're going to talk about another one of those in a future episode as well. But the score by the Chemical Brothers really adds to the tone of the movie. You know, even though they are an electronic music group, and I think, you know, for detractors, that means mechanical sounding. The music feels really alive here in ways. You know, it does help express the emotional journey that Hannah goes through. And it also, you know, helps hype up the action scenes, like that wonderful piece of music that is playing when Hannah is escaping from the Moroccan facility. Mm-hmm. And then also you have some creepy elements as well, as when Isaacs is humming the piece of music that plays in his club, The Devil in the Details. Actually, he's not humming it, he's whistling it, yeah. Which makes it even creepier. So that I think works very well. And it's not the only piece of music that's used very effectively in the movie. There's also the initial time when Hannah is hiding out in the trailer of the family, when she's hiding out in the back, and Sophie, even though she's very modern, she and Miles are all dancing and moving around to David Bowie's song Kooks, along with, of course, Rachel and Sebastian doing that as well. And that's a very effective scene, and that contains a shot in there that did sort of convince me when I saw the trailer to give this movie a try. And by the way, the cinematography was by Alwyn H. Kukler. But it's the shot that we have of Hannah's point of view when she's looking through the hole in the wall, and Miles sees her and he immediately leans up close and puts his finger to his lips. You know, I thought that was a very effective shot. But the music in general, I think, is by the Chemical Brothers, and the other choices of music here adds to the tone of the movie very well.
Yeah, now let me ask you, because I know that they have done songs for movies previously. Like they contributed some tracks to Vanilla Sky and to The Hunger Games. But are there other films for which they are basically have done the entire soundtrack the way, say, Trent Reznor has done for films?
Let me find that out, because I do not know the answer to that. It does not look like they did the score for any other movies aside from this one. I think this was a one-shot deal, that most of their work has been used in the soundtracks of movies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, you know, that's...
Who knows? Maybe this could turn into a thing the way it did for Reznor and for Danny Elfman, too.
And then also for the one that we'll be talking about in a few episodes from now, Johnny Greenwood.
Spoiler alert, man.
Yes, but now, quite frankly, Joe Wright is the last director that I would have expected something like this. He is mostly known for making what are called prestige dramas. He first came to fame with his adaptation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, which ironically, at least in the look, was a lot grittier than most other Austen movies have been, in the fact that he really emphasized the fact that there were big differences as far as wealth goes between Elizabeth's family and Mr. Darcy's family. Elizabeth's family was all dirt and not very striking costumes, where Mr. Darcy's dressed a little better. But it worked. Then he did adaptation of Ian McEwan's Atonement, which where Ronan first got noticed, and she got an Oscar nomination out of that. And I'm not one who thought that movie worked as well as this one or Pride and Prejudice did. Admittedly, Ian McEwan is a very tricky novelist to adapt, but I don't think Wright got the tone of that. Then he did a movie called The Soloist, which is not a literary adaptation. It was based on a true story. And it's one of those movies that, in the wrong hands, it could have been really treacly. It's about a journalist who befriends a homeless and mentally challenged former classical pianist played by Jamie Foxx. But somehow Wright made it work. I mean, it helped. He had Robert Downey Jr. as a journalist, giving a terrific performance. And then most recently, he's known for a audacious, if not quite successful, adaptation of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, and also a movie called The Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman giving an Oscar-winning performance as Winston Churchill. It's one of those movies where, you know, it does unfortunately fall into a lot of docudrama cliches, but the direction makes you forget about all that, because this is not, it was not directed in the way that period pieces are normally done. It's done with a lot of moving camera, a lot of flashy editing, and it is sort of entertaining if you're in the right mood for it. But Hannah, I think, is still his best movie. It's the one that I connected to the best, and I think it is also technically proficient in ways that I'm going to mention in a moment. But Claude, you're about to say something.
Yeah, I think I'm going to generally agree with you. I mean, I think I liked Atonement a little bit more than it sounds like you did. But I understand where your concerns come from. But this was pretty good, and I'm actually has me in a position of I kind of want to see more of his stuff, because I'm looking at his IMDb and I'm like, wow, there is stuff that I have somehow missed, and is like, I kind of want to see how he did what, you know, these particular things did. I did hear that was it Alfonso Cuarón was kind of on board for this for a little while, and that would have been kind of interesting to see.
Yes,
but Wright did a fabulous job.
Yes. And as I said, Wright was brought in by Ronan.
Oh, okay.
Who, because she had worked with him on Atonement, she suggested him for the movie. Now, one of the things that he does here, as with Bride with White Hair, because of the budget, he had to... he had to basically strip this down a lot. There were some more elaborate, in some of the action scenes that we see, such as Hannah escaping from the facility and Eric battling in the train station, which I'm going to come back to in a moment. Originally, they were done in a more elaborate manner, but because of the budget, he had to cut it down. But the one way that that battle on the train station is done in an elaborate manner is it's all done in one take.
A single take, yeah.
Now, obviously, they had to disguise that with a couple clever cuts there, but it is still all one take. Now, one of the reasons why I was not as big a fan of Atonement as you were is the tracking shot that's contained in that movie, I thought was a bit show-offy. But the tracking shot in this movie, in Eric's battle, I think it works.
Yeah, it does, because you're following him down the stairs and into the station and looking around, and you it's not quite a point of view shot because Eric is there for a lot of it, but you're also kind of like, okay, you're there with him and we're both sort of looking around us kind of feeling. And so you're starting to feel the pressure just the way Eric is, as the various bodies start encroaching upon him and closing in, and then the fight starts. I think it worked out really, really well, raising up the overall tension before the fight even begins.
And yes, and he also directs the actors very well. Now, whether or not, getting back to Eric Bana and Kate Blanchett, whether or not you think Bana's German accent works effectively and does kind of go out in a couple of scenes, you know, I think overall he gives a very good performance as Hannah's would-be father. There's some humor in there as well, like when Hannah is cutting his beard and his hair to prepare him to go out. Because remember, in those early scenes in Finland, he's got this really long hair, shaggy beard, and she cuts half of it off. And he asks, is it ready? And she says, almost. And then he turns around and we get a look
and
at that.
That's the reveal.
And he plays it in a he doesn't overplay the joke there. And at the same time, we get the pain inside him as well. When he, you know, near the end of his very last scene with Hannah, when she's fighting him, and, you know, there's the reveal that he's not really her father. And then, you know, he says to her, you know, I tried to prepare you, and you can see how really hurt he is by all that. And then he does it, and I think he does a good job with that.
Yeah, he carries it off very well. And I bumped a little bit on the accent thing, but, you know, the other thing is, this is a guy, he's a CIA agent, so he's presumably American. He's been in Europe for a very, very long time. He speaks multiple languages. So, yeah, chances are he's going to kind of lapse in and out of one accent or another as he goes along. So I kind of went with that a little bit. Said, okay, fine. That's we're good.
And then Kate Blanchett, whom I've been a big fan of ever since Oscar and Lucinda, which came out about 25 years ago. And she's very effective as Marissa. I remember seeing her in interviews where she joked about the fact that she saw this as an action version of Kramer versus Kramer, and which I think adds to the emotional level in the movie. But, you know, she's good at playing someone who, as she puts it, has made certain choices in her life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's also, you know, very good, whether she's being hard-edged or seductive, as she is with Miles, and when she's trying to get information out of him, and then also with Isaacs when she's trying to convince him to take on the job of hunting down Hannah. But, you know, she also shows some unexpected vulnerability as well near the end in that final confrontation with Hannah, when she's, even though you know that she wants to kill her, you almost believe there for a moment, no, she's trying to make it work between the two of them as her mother type figure. But yeah, Lancia does a very good job.
Yeah, no argument there. I mean, I think I first saw her in, I want to say, The Aviator. I know it's not like it's hardly her first, you know, feature film, but I think that's the one where I first noticed her, because, you know, I know, like, I'm a little bit of a nerd, but I it took me a long time to get to Lord of the Rings. I did not see those theatrically, so.
Wow.
Yeah, so I didn't see her there. So I think it would have been Aviator.
What about Talented Mr. Ripley?
Oh, yeah, that's right. She was in that too, wasn't she? I did see that first. I didn't see it in the theater, but I did see that one first.
Okay, because I saw that in the theater. I remember when reading the interviews that cast members were giving about the movie, that was when she really impressed me as a person, not just as an actress, because everyone else doing interviews about the movie were exalting the characters that they were playing. And she said that whenever her character appeared on the screen, she wanted the audience to go, oh God, not her again. So, I mean, I know you're not supposed to judge your characters, but she at least was not sentimentalizing her either, which I thought was very good. And she doesn't sentimentalize Marissa either.
No, she doesn't.
Now, a couple of other the supporting actors I want to mention here as well. Tom Hollander as Isaacs. He was also in The Soloist. He plays someone who Robert Downey Jr.'s character turns to at one point in the movie to help out at least the music part of Jamie Foxx's character. But I had mostly known him up to that point as playing the somewhat befuddled minister in the great savage comedy spinoff of the BBC series The Thick of It, the movie In the Loop, which, if you've never seen it, it's made by the same guy who went on to do the show Veep. And it's one of the funniest and most pointed movies ever made. You should see it. But he does a 180 degree turn here and is really creepy as Isaacs. I mean, you get just the implication, but it's there, the fact that his character is a pedophile.
Yes.
And he's really perverted in other ways as well. And yet he does that without ever slipping into camp, which I appreciated.
Right. He does that. And it's also just that whistling, which I get, you know, it's possible that's kind of a thing that he lifted from, M? The Peter Lorre movie?
Yes.
It's the same kind of thing, just like kind of whistling, and you know he's around, but you don't know where exactly. And it's like a little bit weird and scary. And, you know, and he just manages to carry off this, you know, perfectly normal looking, normal sounding psychopath. He's got just these, like, you know, he's got what I call the Manson lamps. It's just like he can do it with the eyes, you know, and really turn it on. This, like, that's where you see the crazy coming from.
Right. Now, two other supporting actors I want to mention. And actually, in addition to Michelle Dockery giving her first performance, another person who makes one of, if not their first appearances in an English language movie anyway, the woman who plays Hannah's biological mother is played by Vicky Creeps, mm-hmm. who went on to gain notice in Paul Thomas Anderson's movie The Phantom Thread, and who's in a movie that we're going to talk about in a future episode as well. But the supporting players that I want to mention are Olivia Williams and as Rachel, and Jessica Bardem as Sophie. Now, Olivia Williams, she made her film debut in Kevin Costner's misbegotten adaptation of the science fiction novel The Postman. But ever since then, she's recovered and gone on to do some really interesting work throughout her career. Their most well-known movie probably is The Sixth Sense.
Yeah, probably.
Where she has to carry off the major reveal of the movie and does it extremely well. But she's also good in Rushmore. She's in another movie with a twist ending that's not so well known, but is worth checking out. World War II submarine / somewhat supernatural movie called Below. And also she was terrific in The Ghost Rider. And I'm told she was very good on the TV show Manhattan. And she was also good on the TV show Dollhouse. And she's playing sort of this hippie-ish character in this movie. And she manages to pull it off without any condescension whatsoever. And she and Jason Fleming make a good team, as well as being people who like Hannah but are very befuddled by her.
Yeah.
Especially when they're asking Hannah how her mother died, and she responds, three bullets.
Yeah, that was a nice bit. And yeah, I think Olivia Williams, she does a pretty good job. Like I said, she's got this like hippie vibe going on. She's a little bit flaky, and at the same time, she does have her feet on the ground. So it's a well-rounded kind of character. And like you said, they're not quite sure what to do with her, but they are willing to help her out to the extent that they can.
Right. Now, probably the most divisive performance in the movie, at least from what I've read, is Jessica Bardem as Sophie. She's playing a British valley girl, I think is the best way to describe her. And it's sort of like the performance that she gave in the previous movie that I had seen her in, which is a Stephen Frears movie called Tamara Drew, which was a modern-day version of Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd. And, obviously, what you think of her depends on how much you can tolerate what she's doing in that performance. She does give a very different performance in the one other thing that I've seen her in, which was the movie The Lobster, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. Even though I didn't like that movie as much, I will admit she does play against type well there. But, you know, I liked her. She is a convincing in that type of role. And at the same time, she does show a nice bit of vulnerability in the scene that she and Hannah have together when they're lying side by side to each other and looking at each other in the trailer. And Hannah is telling her real life story. And, you know, I think Bardem does that. So when right before Hannah runs out of the trailer, when she's going to be chased by Isaacs and everybody, and she says to Sophie, "Thank you for being my friend," you believe the friendship that has developed between the two of them.
Yeah, you absolutely do. Like when Sophie first comes on the scene, she's doing kind of a mean girl thing at first. And it was a little bit much for me. I would like, I think we're just like trying to establish her a little bit too quickly. But I get that she's supposed to be like kind of this, you know, bratty know-it-all sort of teen, and like, how are you so out of the loop on these things? But it generally works for the most part. And as you say, that scene in the trailer, yeah, it worked out really, really well. And you do buy that some sort of friendship has developed between the two.
Okay. But the movie, of course, rests on the head and shoulders of Ronan. And she is not only very convincing in the action scenes, she also is convincing in making this, as Wright called it, basically a coming of age story for her. You know, that moment at the end when Marissa, right before she kills Eric, says to him, "Why now?" And he says, "Kids grow up." And yeah, that's basically what Hannah is doing here. She's not just learning about the world as it is, as opposed to what Eric has told her. She's also growing up. You know, some ways it's comical, like when she and Sophie are out on a double date and the boy tries to kiss her, and she explains in encyclopedia terms what a kiss is, and then she throws him to the ground. Yeah. But, you know, you really do get her emotional journey, and Ronan, as we've seen when we talked about the 2019 version of Little Women, knows how to make that work. She did it in that movie and she does it here.
Yeah, between that and, as I mentioned earlier, like just like her fascination and maybe even like a bit of like at first, you know, fright almost at some of the modern conveniences when the light goes on and she's like, "Wow, is that everywhere?" You know, when the TV goes on and she has no idea what that's about, when the kettle comes on and she's just like looking around. And you do bump for a moment on the scene where she's in the internet cafe, but I figure, okay, you know, somebody just took the time to teach her how to use a computer. That's not a big deal.
Well, there was a deleted scene showing that. Okay. But yeah.
Yeah, but that's the thing. You can fill in that blank. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. Now, one last thing I do want to mention before we wrap this up. Mm-hmm. Although there are no major Middle Eastern characters in the movie that are shown, actually two things. They're all treated, I think, with respect. You know, this is not the usual white European one or at best two-dimensional portraits of, you know, people of another race. You know, I think, you know, they are anything that Hannah is weirded out by has nothing to do with the fact that they're non-white characters. It's to do with the fact that they have all these modern conveniences that she doesn't understand.
Oh, to be sure, yeah.
Yeah, so, and then the other thing I want to add real quick, guy who runs the theme park, Netflix, is played by Martin Wuttke, who we're going to talk about in a future movie, but who most people might remember as Adolf Hitler in Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Bastards. You wouldn't guess it, but yeah. Okay, so do you have anything else you want to add before we wrap this up, Claude?
Just one thing. I think there are a lot of times when I think character names are important, and this one turns out, I think, to have a little bit of weight to it. Because the name Hannah, which actually comes from the Hebrew, and it means basically like God has favored me with a child. And given that she's basically the only survivor of this particular CIA program, and that Eric has taken her on as a daughter, that I think falls into place very nicely.
Yes. And that reminds me of one other thing I did want to bring up. Have you ever read Stephen King's Firestarter?
Yes, a long time ago.
That is one of my favorite King books. And the movie version, starring a person we're not going to mention right now because we're a little angry at them.
She's on the outs with the union right now, yes.
Yeah. The movie version, I agree with King, was pretty lifeless. It is close to the book as far as the plot goes until the very end, although the magazine that's mentioned in the novel, we're also pretty much on the outs from right now as well. But anyway, even though the movie of Hannah, as far as the plot goes, is very different in the fact that no character in Hannah has otherworldly abilities. You know, there's no telekinesis. No one can set someone, controlling someone's mind with your own mind. No one is able to set things on fire just because they will it. You know, I think spiritually speaking, also because they both involve people who gain these powers through underground government programs that the government then tries to kill off all the participants in, I think this is a better adaptation of Firestarter than the movie Firestarter was.
Ooh, that's an interesting way of framing it. Okay.
Okay. So if you want to watch either of these movies, Bride with White Hair, you'd have to dig around to find a Region 1 DVD, as Claude, to his
learn that the hard
dismay,
way.
Learned that. Hannah is available on regular DVD, but if you want to watch these online, Bride with White Hair, you can only rent or buy through Apple TV. Now, the good news is it is subtitled. However, you do have to remember that any rental or purchase from Apple TV has to be done through iTunes. little public service announcement that both Claude, because both Claude and I ran into that.
Yeah, you can't just use the Apple TV app. You have to buy it.
No. Hannah is much easier to access. You can currently watch that on Netflix if you subscribe to them without the commercials, or if you have the plan with the commercials, or you can watch it on the USA streaming service, or you can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV / iTunes, and most other streaming services.
Okay, and what's happening next time around?
Next time, we're going to take a look at what happens when icons meet. Icons meaning famous figures, celebrities. And the movies we'll be discussing there are from the year 1985, Insignificance, directed by Nicholas Roeg. And from the year 2020, One Night in Miami, directed by Regina King. Both of those are available on Criterion DVD, but if you want to watch them online, you can only stream Insignificance through the Criterion channel, or you can rent or buy it exclusively through Amazon. As for One Night in Miami, you can stream that exclusively through Amazon Prime if you subscribe. And we have a website of our own, wordsandmovies.com, and you can leave a comment on any of our posts, or you can email us through wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. And we also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/wordsandmovies. And we now have an Instagram account, which is instagram.com/wordsandmoviespod.
Correct.
Okay, and I myself am also on Facebook under my name, Sean Gallagher, and I lurk on Instagram as well.
You can find me on the Book of Face under my own name, and you can also check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com.
All right, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you very much. Alex, please take us out.
This is your announcer, Alexander Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare, and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Spotify for podcasters. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.